Hi there again, and welcome back to the Explaining History podcast. The thing that I want to talk about right now is the pressure that the First World War placed upon German society. The spirit of 1914, a spirit of social unity, where upper middle class and working class Germans seem to be united in support for the war, even minorities like Poles in the East were part of the kind of the enthusiasm of a national unity, is referred to in German as Bergfried, or peace within the fortress, a spirit of national unity where social distinctions were swept away. It was this kind of idea that the Nazis looked to when they wanted to create their racial Volksgemeinschaft, that all Germans would be united under the banner of ethnic and racial fraternity. It didn't necessarily mean that real distinctions between social classes, i.e. economic ones, would be swept away. And this fervour by the end of the war is gone. It's been destroyed by the economic and social crises of the war. The Kaiser in 1914 says, "I know of no parties anymore, only Germans." It lasts till 1916, really, and it was based on the belief that among the public the war was progressing well for Germany, so it had to be based on this illusion. The German commanders ensured that there was a filtering system from the front back to Germany. It's extremely effective, and so that bad news didn't get through. However, by the winter of 1916, the strains of war are telling on German society, and it's almost impossible to keep German people ignorant of the crises they're facing because they are being experienced in terms of food shortages. The division between rural and urban areas is particularly acute, and this is largely to do with food shortages. Germany is basically reliant on imports, like all European countries. By the early 20th century, the populations have grown to such a level that self-sufficiency is no longer an option. Autarky was not possible in 1914. It certainly wasn't going to be possible during the Second World War, no matter how much Hitler wanted it. The poor decision-making of the government accentuated these problems. In 1915, for example, the government killed 35% of the country's pigs in order to save grain for animal fodder that would be used as animal fodder, leading to meat shortages and inflation in meat prices. And in 1916 to 17, the winter that year was referred to as the turnip winter. Across Europe, there were freezing cold temperatures, and the men at the front suffer particularly badly, soldiers having all sorts of amputations from frostbite. In Germany, the potato crop, one of the staples of the German diet, was destroyed in the autumn of 1916, and the failure of the crop, combined with the British naval blockade, meant that Germans were forced to rely on turnips as their main source of food. The shortages of even turnips and the difficulty of harvesting them, digging them out of the ground, and the freezing weather began the process of starvation in Germany, and growing opposition to the war based on that. Starving urban populations became highly suspicious of the German peasantry. They thought that they were hoarding food. And it's very interesting how many parallels of this you see during the Soviet five-year plans, when there are food shortages in the cities. The government, their instinctive explanation for this is that it is due to selfish speculators amongst the peasants hoarding food. There are Maoist equivalents of it and Leninist equivalents of it. So it's a kind of a commonly recurring theme in 20th century history. The peasants became extremely resentful towards the war for labour shortages and the inflation that it brought, and the impact on the ability to harvest that happened as a result of requisitioned horses. So it's hunger, really, that cracks the German Burgfried sentiment and the passion for the war and patriotic spirit. The losses associated with this hunger are quite extraordinary. During the First World War, 750,000 Germans died of diseases relating to starvation. That's the low estimate. The high puts it at above 1,000,000. The fall of the Kaiser can be directly attributed to hunger. So the Royal Navy that came to a bloody standstill with the German fleet in 1916 at the Battle of Jutland ultimately exacts a terrible price from Germany through blockading. The hunger in Germany isn't completely due to the blockade, but in large part it is due to it. It was so successful that the British, after the First World War, believed that a similar fleet that operating from Singapore could blockade the Japanese home islands into starvation. And this was the basis of the Singapore strategy, which ends in disaster in 1942 with the fall of Singapore itself. The idea that the Japanese might come down the mainland would have been largely missed there. But the protests and riots across the country due to hunger very quickly came to have a class aspect to them. The solidarity across classes had gone by 1916, and the belief that the upper classes were working the black market, and the working classes and the Mittelstand, the lower middle class, were being left out of the picture, caused great resentment. There was a demand for improved wages that would enable the working classes to keep up with rising inflation, and this leads to strikes that begin in about 1916. By early 1917, 200,000 workers were on strike in Berlin. And one of the reasons for this is bread rationing. Starvation becomes an almost everyday occurrence in parts of Germany. There's a difference between there being starvation, pockets of starvation, and mass famine. The mass famine isn't perhaps quite as pronounced as, say, the Soviet famines, and certainly not the Maoist famine of 58 to 62. Proportionally, by the end of the war, it can be said that famine conditions exist in Germany. 2.5 million men by 1917 had been killed and wounded, and there seemed to be no end to the war in sight. In fact, if you recall, I did a podcast a week or so ago on the sense that Germany had of being encircled, and the fact that Germany had to fight a war on multiple fronts meant that it was virtually impossible to win, and Germany would be worn down by attrition. The continuation of the war meant that there would be little on the table for workers. Even if the country was victorious, it would be such a pyrrhic victory that there's nothing that that Germany's working classes could get out of it. And the Burgfried that I mentioned at the start of the podcast, this was only really based on the assumption that victory would be likely. Social contracts, social agreements between large numbers of people only really ever held together when all parties are anticipating getting something out of the scenario. That way, a certain degree of sacrifice can be bargained for. German society was becoming highly fractured by 1917 under the pressure of war. One of the key players in all of this is, as I mentioned earlier, the lower middle class, or Mittelstand. The Mittelstand were made up of artisans and small businesses, and the focus of the economy is on mass production. Mass production of munitions and foods is where the resources of German society are going. This puts an intense pressure on small businesses, so and the members of the Mittelstand. And the German bourgeoisie, the upper middle classes, also find their status being eroded by the war. It becomes very difficult, for example, to find servants. Wages stagnate and savings become pretty worthless. War bonds that are purchased by the middle classes turn to be poor investments. And the strong resentment existed towards the elites, particularly because most of the elites in Germany were Prussians. And this provided people in non-Prussian parts of of Germany, such as Bavaria, with ample ammunition to point at their sort of social superiors. The Prussian elites had always enjoyed, for example, taxation privileges until 1916, and they had used their status to get food that was not available for the majority of the population. This idea of all in it together, this Bergfried notion, quickly evaporates. The damaging effect of ordinary Germans believing that the rest of society isn't pitching in are quite catastrophic. And that means really things like Bergfried are always based on sort of illusions. Any time the notion of all in it together is bandied around is normally not true. The war brings out all sorts of doubts and questions in Germans who are used to a fairly authoritarian, fairly militarized tradition in the country of questioning whether the war is actually worth continuing, whether it's not better to find some sort of negotiated settlement. The feeling of doubt grows by the political situation that had essentially meant that the government was turned over to the running, to being run by the military, by Hindenburg and Ludendorff. The military is basically given, after 1916, wide-ranging emergency powers, and they're able to administer the economy and society. The Kaiser at this point has essentially had something of a nervous breakdown and retreated from government, and his inability to have any meaningful role to play in the war meant that he was sidelined and ignored. He's treated by 1918 as a rather contemptible figure by the army. Many of the senior generals had no time for him at all. Pressure was put on the Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg to allow the German military to pursue the war in any way it see fit. It saw fit, so to completely and utterly break with any kind of civilian oversight. And to give you a comparison, during the shell crisis of 1915 in Great Britain, generals critiqued the government openly. The Asquith government was deeply disliked by them, and they tended to prefer to report straight to the king. Generals like French and Haig saw themselves, and Rawlinson saw themselves basically as the king's generals, and they didn't understand why on earth they would be speaking to and taking instruction from a civilian prime minister, one who perhaps wasn't from quite as lofty a social position as they were. However, in the United Kingdom, civilian government remains firmly intact, and when it comes to a showdown between, in 1916, showdowns between Lloyd George and the generals, Lloyd George by and large wins. The problem for Germany by 1916, going through all this suffering, is that any kind of legitimacy that the government may have had, any kind of sense of loyalty to the Kaiser, is undermined by the fact that Germany has essentially become a military dictatorship, and the pain of the war that ordinary people have to experience is seen by them as simply the results of the general's private hobby. and the interests of the Prussian military class. So within this all, we see the rise of Hindenburg and Ludendorff, who in the second half of the war really become the pivotal military and political figures in Germany.
Following the Battle of Verdun, where 200,000 German lives were lost, and the attempt to, as General Erich von Falkenhayn put it in the Falkenhayn letter in late 1915 to the Kaiser, to bleed France white, he knew that the French would defend Verdun no matter the cost. There are huge casualties caused, and yet not enough for a final breakthrough, and the failure of the offensive leaves Chancellor Bethmann-Hollweg to replace Falkenhayn with Hindenburg. Hindenburg distinguished himself at the Battle of Tannenberg, where he'd destroyed the entire Second Russian Army, and his second-in-command, Erich von Ludendorff, and Hindenburg both became national heroes as a result. Bethmann-Hollweg hoped that he could tap into this acclaim by 1916, when he made the appointment, again, because of this decline in national morale. The decision turned out to be a mistake for Bethmann-Hollweg. The Kaiser and Bethmann-Hollweg were both sidelined, and Hindenburg and Ludendorff established complete supremacy over the war and over German society as well. The Kaiser is no longer consulted on military matters, considered to be kind of fairly incompetent, which he was, and instead Hindenburg and Ludendorff's decisions were unquestioned. One of the great problems here is that by 1918 the Ludendorff Spring Offensive goes ahead despite it having numerous failings, because Ludendorff really has no one to oppose him. They set the entire military and economic and political agenda in Germany. They establish the Auxiliary Service Act, that essentially developed the German war economy, and which created many of the post-war inflation problems that Germany faced. They had the power of appointment and could sack ministers as they saw fit. They were determined that the war should go on until final victory was achieved, so they essentially dismissed the idea of negotiation. And they wanted to reward Germany for its sacrifices with territorial gains. For example, before the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with the newly revolutionary Russia was signed, the Kreuznach program was a secret plan to annex huge territories, Poland, the Baltic states, and indeed in the West there were designs on the coal-rich territories of France and Belgium. The Kreuznach program even demanded that Romania's newly discovered oil fields be handed over to Germany. So despite the view that many Germans had that the war was a defensive war because of Germany's perceived encirclement by 1914, the reality was that for certain members of the German military, this was an economic war, an economic smash and grab for resources and territory. At least by 1916, these are the war aims that are secretly established. Ludendorff's disasters on the Western Front in 1918 were one of the things he did to seal Germany's fate. The other, the year before, was the reinstitution of the unrestricted submarine warfare programme against Great Britain, but against any ship so from any nation travelling to a British port. The policy had been abandoned in 1915 because it posed the very real risk of drawing America into the war. In 1917, the German military decided to resume this, and it's at Ludendorff's insistence. Bethmann-Hollweg again is against the policy, seeing it as folly, but Ludendorff has his way, and the programme begins. The strategy was a failure. It didn't stop supplies getting to Britain, but all it did was enrage the United States of America. And the other and even more ludicrous plan was that outlined in the Zimmermann telegram, a message from the German Foreign Office to the German embassy in Mexico, an offer to try to draw Mexico into a potential war against the United States, offering the repatriation of territories lost to America in 1848. America's entry into the war was prompted by a sinking of American ships, but also the provocation of the Zimmermann telegram is really too much to... So even despite these problems, world events happening around Germany cause significant problems as well. For example, the Russian Revolution in February 1917 saw one autocratic regime swept away, and it had a deep resonance with Germany's working class, and from the left-wing liberal elements of the bourgeoisie. So there was desperate energies poured into trying to resist revolution in Germany, and Bethmann-Hollweg says to the Kaiser, and in the Kaiser's Easter message, that you really must promise some sort of social reform. And the Kaiser, listening to this, he's deeply frightened, very concerned what has happened to his cousin, the Kaiser, in Russia. And he said that once the war ends, the electoral system in Germany, particularly the electoral system in Prussia, will be reformed and the franchise expanded. And Bethmann-Hollweg said that really more needed to be done, concrete social reform, and needed to be offered. It was Ludendorff that puts pressure on the Kaiser, really, to make sure that what he's saying is pretty thin stuff, pretty nebulous and insubstantial. The response from Ludendorff at the same time as well is that he says that any kind of compromise in the face of Bolshevism is a sign of weakness, and he denounces whatever promises the Kaiser actually makes. Bethmann-Hollweg resigns in July 1917, and the Kaiser appoints Georg Michaelis, a figure who is extremely politically weak and not able to stand up to either Ludendorff or to Hindenburg. He has no authority in the Reichstag, and one SPD deputy said that he was a fairy angel tied to a Christmas tree at a Christmas for children's benefit. Now, a combination of events, the Russian Revolution in February 1917, the introduction of America into the war, the political crisis that sees Bethmann-Hollweg resign in July 1917, and the vagueness of the Kaiser's Easter statement sees the Bergfrieden well and truly end in 1917. When it looks as if conflict with America is inevitable and American productive power will no doubt grind Germany into the ground, the SPD, the Social Democratic Party, propose a war without territorial annexations. The SPD, while Bethmann-Hollweg is in power, asked him and put pressure on him to distance himself from the Kreuznach programme, and the justification for the war previously had been the terrifying menace of Russia bearing down on Germany meant that any kind of defensive war was justifiable, but a war with a democratic state
like America, that the SPD rather admired, seemed to be less justifiable, less sustainable, and, you know, almost certainly likely to be lost. The Centre Party politician, Matthias Erzberger, stepped up at this point. He'd previously been an enthusiastic supporter of the war, and he had previously been a demander of huge annexations, wanting France and Belgium's African empires. He wanted a huge reparations bill dumped on the enemy. He wanted the annexation of parts of Belgium, Poland, the Ukraine, the Baltic, parts of France. And he was a proponent initially of submarine warfare, but then understood that it had been a total failure. When he went to the Eastern Front, he saw the situation there, and he spoke with the men, the commanders on the front, and by 1917 he could see that the war either had no end in sight or defeat in sight. And here begins his conversion, really, to a peace resolution. He called for a peace resolution, and that meant a peace without victory, which really meant a peace at any price, which would bring the war to an end and prevent Germany from achieving the Kreuznach programme of mass territorial expansion. A committee of Reichstag deputies are set up, a cross-party committee with members of the SPD, the Progressives, the National Liberals and the Centre Party, drafting the peace resolution. And it was approved by a substantial majority in the Reichstag of 86 votes, which called for a lasting peace based on friendly understanding amongst peoples and the end of force and the end of territorial annexations and oppression in all forms. So the result kind of backfires, however. Ludendorff and Hindenburg were opposed to the resolution, but they saw it as a method to push for Bethmann Hollweg's removal as Chancellor, saying basically he had lost control over the Reichstag. So, and they used military leaders to tender their resignations, and then unless Bethmann Hollweg went. The naivety of Erzberger was that he'd hoped that if Bethmann Hollweg did go, he'd be replaced by a stronger figure who could put pressure on the two generals and end their silent dictatorship. They sabotaged any potential peace talks by insisting that Michaelis had to insert into any discussion with the British the demand for territories that Germany wanted in order to secure a peace, something that the Western Allies were never going to submit to. And Ludendorff, at the same time, sets up what you might think of as a kind of a proto-fascist party in the Vaterland Party, or Fatherland Party, which was a coalition of nationalists and conservatives supported with the army and industrial money of industrialists and various significant media backers. By 1918, it has over a million members and has at its disposal the army's propaganda service in disseminating a strong message which designed to sabotage any peace resolution by Erzberger, meaning that Erzberger was essentially sabotaged. So here what we can see amidst blockades and starvation is the dictatorial elements within the German army being strengthened by a democratic deficit in Germany, which predated the war. It's only simply accentuated by the war. It predates it. It redates it all the way back to the creation of the Bismarck Constitution in 1871. Anyway, this has been way too long, so I hope I haven't bored you. But if you can give us a good thumbs up on the iTunes, the Explaining History iTunes page, that would be great. 5 stars if you can. And thanks very much for your time. And I'll catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.